bloody have it then, shall we?
Let's bloody have it. Let's get this nice and close.
It's Brittany. Meow, meow,
meow. Hello everyone and welcome to Out of Print. This is a podcast with a sort of literary twist, but involves lots and lots of analysis of pop culture as myself, Sophie.
Me, Emmeline.
And me, Alice.
Use texts, whether contemporary or historical, to sort of decode culture and young life around us. Emmeline, I believe you are hostess with the mostest. What are we talking about this week?
I am. If you can tell, obviously this is an audio podcast, but for a visual description, I'm wearing a Britney jumper, which is a nice visual cue.
Iconic hoodie.
This week.
Yeah, it's sick.
We'll get into it in a bit, but we're going to be talking vaguely about pop girlies.
Okay, fun.
Does anyone have any... Who's your favourite pop girlie? Mm. Does anyone... That's a good question for the table.
It probably is Britney Spears.
Yeah.
I'm a huge Britney fan, and...
Oh, you wrote a great essay... uni
for the music publication I used to work for. The article essentially covered off like lots of people are really into retro pop icons like Britney Spears, and I don't know, like you could even pull in like your Diana Ross and stuff like that.
Sure.
But will refuse to listen to their modern contemporaries. So for example, like Dua Lipa would not be considered a cool artist to listen to.
Mm.
And like my article kind of argued that nostalgia allows people to go back and like listen to those pop icons because enough time has passed that people forgot that it was like music aimed at teenage girls. And now your edgy sort of Anthony Fantano fanboys will be like, enough time has passed. I can admit that actually it's a bit of a banger.
Mm-hmm.
So, but yeah, I love Britney Spears and true to form, I also love Dua Lipa. So.
Do you? I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah. I'm actually quite a large Dua Lipa fan.
Really? Does she have a name for her fandom? I don't know this.
Maybe, I don't know.
I've not heard of one, but apparently like, I asked my younger colleague.
Yeah.
Who's like 19, 20. What the kids are listening to these days.
Did you phrase it like that?
Something like that, yeah. I was at the pub with her. I'd taken her out and I had three drinks and I was like, so what are the kids into these days?
Dribbling and slurring. Yeah.
And she said that, obviously, like for us, I think Charlie XCX, it was like during that summer, like Charlie XCX, Sabrina,
yeah,
and Chapel. For younger people, it's Dua Lipa. Like she's the
It
girl, which is interesting because I think for in our age group, and we're only a few years older,
yeah,
Dua Lipa is considered a bit, I think, basic.
Nah,
right. I'm not hating on Dua Lipa.
Let me come to
the great Dua Lipa debate.
Dua's defense, real quick. She runs a really cool book club, so get lots of young women into reading, which of course we support on this podcast. She's totally uncontroversial. She was like a really shitty dancer a few years ago and she got loads of hate for it and then just spent loads of time like working to become this like really amazing dancer, and now she's like a sick performer. She's just like an uncomplicated, awesome role model and she makes bangers.
Okay.
Her album Future Nostalgia, unbelievable.
Love.
But the last album?
I actually haven't listened to that. After being like, I'm a huge Dua Lipa fan, I've actually not listened to it.
There's a reason you haven't heard it.
Does it stink?
Yeah, it's not good.
Oh,
sorry.
Everyone puts out a dud. All of our faves put out duds.
Yeah. And it's okay to put out a dud. Actually, I think that I feel like it's important to, you know, you can't knock a 10 out of the park every time, can you?
Yeah.
But there's also albums that everyone fucking hates when
they
first come out.
It's true.
Classic example, Kanye West, 808 and Heartbreak. Controversial figure now, obviously, but
cult classic.
Different if someone makes an album that actually stinks, but we might feel differently about it in a couple of years.
Do you think Taylor Swift's Life of a Showgirl is gonna?
No, because she's not a showgirl.
It's gonna grow on us.
She isn't, and like, I'm really sorry to any Swifties that may be listening, but like, there's like a level of authenticity, and because that came out during the time that was it the Sofia or Gia Coppola film came out that was like the last showgirl that had Pamela Anderson
it was
like a very topical time where people were look like kind of drawing from those like burlesque aesthetics and stuff. There's a level of authenticity to it.
I hadn't even connected those two in my brain, but that makes sense
because like the two things came out probably about a year apart.
Yeah.
But Pamela Anderson was someone who'd been abused by the industry, then held up, and then like there was like this kind of sex tape that came out. There was all this stuff. She has lived the life of a showgirl. And I think to kind of use it as an aesthetic and not pay homage to maybe like the sex workers or cabaret performers who came beforehand, you can't just because it's such a taboo topic a lot of the time, I just don't think you can pick it up and drop it like
guys,
that.
Guys, this is so this is really pertinent to everything we're going to be talking about today.
Mm. Okay, fantastic.
My like semi-bait title for the episode, again, I love bait title, is Charlie XCX a lyrical confessionalist? But really the question that I'm asking is about whether the pop stars of our era are confessionalists, and I'll talk about what that means in terms of, it's a term that often gets related to a specific era and type of poetry, but it's basically about authenticity and realism. And yeah, does anyone have any good confessional stories sometime when they've maybe revealed too much, or that they've
it's not actually a story about me. I mean, I overstep the boundary just about every single day, but one of my startup clients, the woman who works in HR, sent me a message and was like, look, I've just got to tell you something. I haven't told anyone else that we work with, but I just have to get this off my chest. And she works in HR. So I was like, oh my God, what's coming? And she was like, I just turned 30 and I went to the Magic Mike show and I was front row and they pulled me up and I had a lap dance and I was allowed to touch his chest, but they said I had to keep my legs closed. And I was like,
why did she tell you that?
I think she was just like, I'm the youngest person that works there and I'm a contractor as well because I'm freelance. So I think she was like, you're a safe person.
Or worried that you might see it online and then she might need to tell you about it.
No. Okay. She was genuinely so excited about it but knew it wasn't appropriate to talk about it because she's head of HR. So now anytime I have like a HR request, I call her the Magic Mikestress. And she's like, I'm really sorry about that. I don't know why I told you. And I felt like, you know, like the priest on the other side of the confessional booth. And she'd just come in and I was the ear that was ready to receive. So I rated that.
It's a compliment to be on the receiving end.
I felt really flattered.
Especially in the workplace. Yeah. It's rare.
I've always wanted to confess. I'm not even religious.
But I should go to confession.
I'd love to just like, as a thing, to, you know, take off the
mate post the post flea bag especially
maybe that's what I've got in my brain.
What would you confess?
I can't tell. That's so against the against the nature of the confession.
But we're not religious.
No,
but I feel like Catholic iconography and like religion and like being down on your knees and repenting and stuff, that very current right now. We're feeling like we're seeing a lot of that.
I know what I'd confess to, and this is exactly the story that I was going to tell you anyway, but it relates very specifically to confessionalism and the diary entry, which is that one of the most embarrassing things that's ever happened to me is when I was younger, I went to a kid's birthday party. Maybe I was like 8 or 9. You know, at that age, it's someone that's not you is responsible for giving a gift to the person who's partying.
Yes.
Not to stereotype, but big up the mums in our life. It's usually the mamas.
My
mum had like kindly like wrapped something up for me last minute and given it me to give this girl whose party it was. And I didn't know what was inside the gift. Have I told you the story?
No, I'm scared of what's coming.
Yeah, I feel like the hairs on the back of my neck are standing up. I don't know why.
It's not good, guys. Anyway, so it got to sort of circle present time and everyone in the group, she was opening her presents and they were like oohs and ahs. And it got to my gift and she like, slowly unwrapped it. And she like peeling off the corner, sort of book-shaped, this item. She's like peeling back the paper. And as she peeled back a little bit of paper, I recognized that the gift it was one of my diaries.
No! I knew it was coming and I still couldn't believe it was coming.
But not even like a diary that I'd filled from cover to cover. Clearly a diary that I'd maybe got 5 pages into, but not got all the way down.
Yeah, because you're like 8 or 9, so you're not.
And I must have either somehow, my mum had flipped through this book and thought that it was empty and was going to be used for a gift, or I misplaced it and put it in the present. I don't know what had gone on, but there was some major error of miscommunication.
Oh my God.
Worse than that, she opened it and started reading it. And there was something in it about her.
Oh my God.
It was something to do with, I'd taken a test at school and either I'd done terribly or really well. And either way, I was like, I was waxing lyrical about this test. Oh. And in it, it was like, so-and-so got so many marks, so-and-so got so many marks, and I got so-and-so.
You fucking meek.
It's so bad.
That actually makes me feel
it's
sick.
It's awful. It's literally really the worst, bad. Most embarrassing thing that's ever happened.
8-year-old me would have cried.
It was
I don't think I would have, like, emotionally.
I think I would have had to, like, vomit or something. change focus or something.
Yeah. just projectile
look
vomit.
Over here! Look at me.
Yeah, legit.
Kiss yourself.
Yeah. Dude, that's actually so rough.
I know, but it's sort of very vaguely ties in with this question. So yeah, is Charlie XCX a lyrical confessionalist? So I guess I'll really briefly state what confessional poetry is for people that don't know. Because that's going to link really well with what we're talking about, which is basically just pop music. So don't worry. It's not going to stay too academic for too long. Confessional poetry is poetry that came out of specifically the 50s and 60s. And it was kind of untrendy and uncool at the time.
Mm.
And the ethos behind it was poets writing pretty candidly about their internal domestic and mental lives.
Okay, yeah.
Particularly ill mental health, which was honestly not very widely discussed in poetic circles at that time. And a lot of writers that you may have heard of, like Sylvia Plath,
Robert Lowell,
Anne Sexton, they were big components of this wave of poetry. And specifically in confessional poetry, when you read it mainly as if the narrator of the poem is the poet rather than a characterful I.
Okay, yeah.
So you are really encouraged to associate the real life with what you're reading rather than with sort of metaphor or narrative. And also importantly, these poets didn't, that their sort of sole focus was on trying to get to the truth of something, and they didn't sacrifice anything in order to do that. They didn't sacrifice form, they didn't sacrifice poetic intention, metaphor, prosody, but they were trying to find something truthful.
Okay, interesting.
And the term came out of, I think it was a review of a book of poems that Robert Lowell had written, a book called Life Studies, which is one of my favorite books of poems.
I don't think I know.
And there was a reviewer who said that in this work, he removed the mask. And that was a phrase that was often associated with confessional poetry, this idea of like moving away from it. So there's a poet called Snodgrass. You can take a minute.
Snodgrass.
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 Snodgrass. What a name.
Sounds kind of swampy.
Yeah.
Sounds very swampy.
Yeah. Well, he really rejected that term confessional poet. Or at least...
Snodgrass.
Yes.
Sorry, I was making comments, but I wasn't actually listening.
Snodgrass.
Is that the man?
Yeah.
That's his name.
Oh, his first name.
His last name.
Oh, right. I was seeing Snodgrass as two separate words.
I thought
Snodgrass.
That was... Sorry. You know what? I don't even know why I asked. I'm wrecking things now.
I'm so sorry.
Sorry.
Let me compose myself.
Mr. Snodgrass.
Can we take anything he's gonna say seriously?
What's the name? We can fucking edit all this out. What's the origin of that name?
I don't know. Sorry. I'm not the pariah of Mr. Snodgrass.
Jeez, oh man.
That's
peak.
He said that it felt like it meant you were writing bedroom memoirs, which is actually this idea of autobiographical fiction and like literary fiction is often a term that gets slapped on a lot of female writers as a kind of negative thing.
Yeah.
Or as a way of being like, you know, I remember reading a lot of Rachel Cusk when I was younger, and a lot of criticism around her work is that it's, you know, it's autofiction, it's, you know, it's navel gazing, it's memoir. Whereas a lot of male writers often the personal is less seen when they write. Whereas I feel like everyone who reads Sylvia Plath reads it thinking of the story of what happened to her. But
yeah.
Anyway, that's a whole other conversation. And lyric poetry is a slightly separate thing, but it's poetry that focuses also on personal experiences, but with a more kind of song-like quality, there's a focus on internal experience rather than story, and a focus on emotion, and it's kind of like a short, concise form. So the reason I've like paired those two things is because they connect really well when talking about music.
Mm-hmm.
So is Charlie XCX a lyrical confessionist? I guess that now we're over the hump of the Brat release and kind of in the after effect of that. We're more aware of the seismic chokehold that female pop stars currently have over mass culture.
Mm-hmm.
It's like these women are dominating trends in listening, trends in buying, trends in aesthetics, trends in behavior. We can talk retrospectively about what seems to also be a trend within that towards confessionalism in their work and in their songwritings.
Mm.
So I'll take you back, I don't know, 10, 15 years, you're listening to the charts. Think of some of the songs that by female pop stars that were really famous when you were growing up. Give me an example.
S&M.
S&M, great example.
Yep. If You Seek Amy by Britney Spears.
Yes. And songs like...
California Girls.
California Girls, exactly. Yeah. So songs like S&M, California Girls, Umbrella... Was anyone thinking at the time, what's the metaphor for the umbrella? What is she? Who is she writing about?
Who are these
what
does California it mean? Girls?
Even when Katy Perry released "I Kissed a Girl," no one was really asking who the girl was
or thinking that she was a lesbian.
Yeah, even or thinking that she was gay, which is I just remember in itself.
I just remember my brother being like, "Have you seen the music video for this?" Woohoo!
Oh, I watched that a lot. I listened to that song a lot.
He was like, "There's girls kissing in this." I was like, "I'm like nine. Like, why are you telling me this?"
So basically, there used to be a lot more separation between singers and songwriters.
Yeah,
it was also a role in music that more people were soul songwriters, more people were soul singers. A lot of the pop stars of the era weren't known for writing their music. So there was a more of a separation, sort of ideologically, between when we heard these people sing and the idea that we were thinking about the way in which this was reflective of their lives. And now, because of the blurring that we have, with particularly with social media and especially parallel the social relationships that we have with a lot of these icons, it's kind of expected that when you hear a song, you're going to get a little bit of information about someone's personal life with it.
Yeah.
Particularly with a lot of young pop stars like Olivia Rodrigo, who one of the big things about her hit song Driver's License was that it was about a boy that she'd had a relationship with who was on a TV show with her, and then Sabrina Carpenter was the other woman in that scenario.
Oh my God.
Yeah, and that was kind of how Sabrina Carpenter came up with this other woman narrative associated with her music.
Oh.
Yeah, so that a lot of pop stars come up with that. And it also kind of started with Beyonce, who had Becky with the good hair.
Yeah.
And then everyone was trying to ask, who's Becky from Lemonade?
Yeah.
And yeah, so all the pop girlies are cutting themselves open and putting it out there on the dance floor. My question is, are they? And to what extent is this authentic? And to what extent is this a sort of poetic device? Maybe that's the first prompt I have for open discussion. Because a lot of these women, you know, particularly like we have Charlie and Brat and we have Taylor and Life of a Showgirl, they all represent different sides of this argument. But at the very least, they're trying to be candid in a certain way about their real lives in order to gain traction in the music industry. And I'm initially interested in how you feel about that before I start connecting it to the poetry.
I mean, I think the authenticity and relatability are both currency.
Yeah.
In today's, not just music industry, but in today's creative landscape. Like, I feel like when I first started writing, and I was writing the first piece that I ever wrote, "Nice to Meet You, I'm a Slut."
Great piece.
Very confessional.
Yeah.
Very, very personal. And that was when I was like 20. I felt like I was rewarded more for sharing more.
Yeah, yeah.
Particularly when I started writing the column and other freelance work I've done about dating apps, because it's not only personal, I write about sex and relationships.
Yeah.
So it's like, how much more personal can you get? Like, it's I'm telling you about like sex that I've been having.
Yeah.
Or like my interpersonal relationships. And I definitely felt at the beginning, and I still feel it a little bit now, but I think I've gotten a lot better at taking a step back.
Yeah.
I felt like I was under a magnifying glass, and the more I shared, like, the editors wanted me to share more. Like, often when I'd submit a draft for my column, I'd have notes from my editor being like, tell me more about this, and she'd always have highlighted the most salacious part. Like, the first column I wrote for that was about shagging my ex-boyfriend on Christmas Day when I was at home for Christmas. Shout out to
the dentist. I have you guys read Goblinhood by Jen Calleja?
No.
So that's my favorite book of all time, and she has a really interesting bit in the book where she's talking about why is it so trendy for people to kind of cut themselves open and be so confessional at the moment. And it's actually written in response to AI, which seems to be my buzzword that I bring up all the time, but it's very relevant.
When
did
the recent
book? It came out last year. Jen Calleja on how to fight AI. She says, the boom in personal essays might have come from journalists and other writers having to drain their own wells. Jen says, I only want writing made by a human, not necessarily for the writing, but because of what's behind it, where it came from, what it took someone to start it, rework it, and complete it. The human will to The human will to write and share one's idiosyncratic ways of thinking, feeling, and then communicating to others take guts. An AI can't relate its criticism or any writing back to its childhood, its influences, and its whims.
Yeah.
So there's, I think there is this thing where there's so much art that's being made, and we're seeing this with like AI songs are being played on the radio now. ChatGPT is just kind of generating all this sort of slop. And I think what's happening is like human creatives are having to just reach in and dredge everything up with the idea of like, okay, the only thing that I can trade off is connecting with other people in this really like personal, intimate way.
Yeah, it's
like
the same humanity.
As, it's the same as I was talking the other week about TikTok and how when you work in music, people want you to be on TikTok and share your personality, but they're actually not asking for something very authentic. They're talking about mechanical process of sharing your life that is not very real. And that leads me to the question, which is how much does this form of confessionality impact the artfulness of women sharing their stories, because it commercializes them at the same time as making them appear more human? And do women feel the need to share their personal stories because it makes them more profitable? Does it also make them more empowered at the same time? Where does the art sit within those things? It's complicated.
It's like performative authenticity, which I think I've seen a lot of Substack writers tackle, because again, it's like the personal essay is very trendy. And I've definitely felt when I first started writing, I would often do things quite literally for the plot.
Yeah.
Even things like shagging my ex-boyfriend on Christmas Day, I thought this is going to make a great piece.
Yeah.
And that's not how you should be thinking. That's not how life should work. But it is this sort of like, is it authentic? Can art or confessionalism really be authentic if you're performing it, if it's inherently...
It's a very kind of like a simulacrum, isn't it?
Yeah, for someone.
I think my big point with this, which is maybe where I've landed after thinking about it for a bit, is that confessional poetry, at the time it was being written, it wasn't reactionary, but it wasn't cool. It was a new thing, and people were scathing about some of that work, and it wasn't the done thing, and it was sort of shocking and interesting for that. Whereas I think confessionality is our modus operandi as artists at the moment, and maybe it weakens and dilutes the message. And I'll bring some examples of a couple poems and a couple artists who I think do it really differently. So Brat, I would consider to be a fairly confessional album.
Yeah.
And it was really interesting for that at the time, because the genre is dance music.
Yeah.
And dance music is known for being euphoric and
sort of escapist.
Escapist, and sure, it touches and on repetitive topics like, and it can touch on topics like drug use and queerness and euphoria. But someone talking about whether or not they're going to have a baby in the next few years, it was a pretty new and novel thing. And there are some really interesting lyrics in Brat that kind of pair quite well with a few writers. So for example, in that song, I Think About It All the Time, where she's talking about whether to have a baby or not, she describes really literally, I was walking around in Stockholm, I went to go and see a friend of mine, she's growing a child inside her, it made me think, do I want to have a baby or am I running out of time?
Yeah.
Which is a pretty like heartfelt and truthful message for that kind of song. And then on Sympathy Is a Knife, she says this line, tell me, why do I want to buy a gun? Why do I want to shoot myself? Which is...
I just want to specify, I'm a big Charlie XCX fan and a huge fan of Brat. But like the stripped backness of the lyrics and the simplicity of it, are we losing the poetry and like the literary devices behind this?
That's bang on the money. Because then I'll compare it to... So there's a poet, Anne Sexton, who is a very prominent confessional poet. She has a really famous poem called The Double Image. It's like, trigger warning, is a pretty harrowing poem where she's beautiful in a way, but harrowing, where she's talking about her relationship between herself as her mother and her daughter and her own mother and talking about mental health. And I think it opens very simply, I am 30 this November. You know, the language is plain and descript. And then there's a line in it, which is, I who choose two times to kill myself.
Oh my God.
And that, okay, so if we're comparing that to tell me why I want to buy a gun, why I want to shoot myself in Charlie. What's the difference? Is there a difference? How does that operate?
I mean, I feel like the first one, the Jan Sexton poem, like, for me, like, that makes you feel something.
It's a bit richer.
Because
I don't think there's not necessarily room for interpretation in what Charlie XCX is saying. She's just saying, this is how it is. I am choosing to share that. And that's still incredibly powerful and super brave. But I think with pop music, where it's kind of packaged up and sent out to the masses, people don't want to sit and interpret it, or a very small percentage of people do. And it's like, I hate the terms high art and low art, but the kind of idea of, like, the more simplistic message that's easier to understand in pop music versus a poem that, you know, literary types, quote unquote, are going to sit and, like, pour through and pull out the images and stuff. So I just wonder if we're losing the depth in going straight into the confession.
Well, it's interesting with Charlie, and I haven't quite got my head around it yet, because there's something about the language being so spare that is quite arresting and interesting, because it's more spare than her other contemporaries who are trying to do something more...
Like Taylor Swift.
Yeah, well, exactly. So... Let me give you a little.
I'm really jumping the gun on this.
That's
one.
Okay. You're going exactly where I wanted you to go. It's
fabulous.
Cool. So I've got a few quotes from the Torture Poets Department.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
No shade to anyone, by the way. This is just an interesting example of, I think, more of a slightly failed attempt at a sort of truthful lyrical confessionism. Yeah. So there's a line: "You smoked, then ate 7 bars of chocolate." We declared Charlie Puth should be a better artist.
What?
"And my friends all smell like weed or little babies. You're not Dylan Thomas. I'm not Patti Smith. This ain't the Chelsea Hotel." So what's really interesting about that, she is aware of the like literary greats that came before her, of the musical greats, of these writers that poured their heart and their soul onto a piece of paper. She references Dylan Thomas. She references Patti Smith.
She's self-aware.
She is self-aware. And she is also trying to translate that confessionalism to a very contemporary audience. So there is a reason she says Charlie Puth and 7 bars of chocolate. She's trying to locate her music so specifically in the current moment that no one could ever take it out of that moment. She's trying to be, you know, she's trying to place herself. I can see the logic and what she's trying to do, but it doesn't work, does it?
No.
Yeah, I have some kind of, like, I have some respect for what she's done, but... Do I think it's beautiful? Absolutely not.
Yeah. And
who's eating 7 bars of chocolate?
Because
the cigarette. Yeah,
obviously, she, coming back to a point about the life of a showgirl, in that album, she has a song called Wood, which is about her boyfriend's dick. Now, pertaining to my point about confessionality and how it's a currency, that song gained so much more traction because it is about her boyfriend's dick than about some fictional woman's boyfriend's dick. Do you want to, do you get, like, there's,
because you know it's a real penis.
Yeah.
It's way more.
The analysis on this podcast is unreal.
As opposed to a fake penis. It's real.
But it's because
you're like, because people want to know something about her relationship and her life, and it's this desire for like weird parasocial closeness with people, and the idea that you know who the dick belongs to, and it's just,
well, we're also fucking nosy as well. Like, an artist's personal life makes us engage more with it, so it's just like sharing more and more and more, and fans are getting nosier and nosier and nosier, and it's like, can you ever satisfy a fan base like that?
And it's so interesting. So one other example, and I will forgive anyone that's a real poetry diehard, because I understand that some of these comparisons are quite heinous, but I think it articulates what I'm trying to get at. So where Taylor Swift uses Charlie Puth, Robert Lowell uses LL Bean. In his poem Skunk Owl, which is one of my favorites, he says, "The season's ill. We've lost our summer millionaire who seemed to leap from an LL Bean catalog." And then there's a break. And later on, he says just this very simple line, "My mind's not right." And this, in this poem where he sets up all these domestic details about this area, and he just slips under the surface this really revealing image about his really poor mental health in that period of time. But in that poem, the detail of the LL Bean catalog is doing something similar to what Taylor Swift is trying to do by mentioning Charlie Puth. He's locating it in a specific period of time. It's a domestic image. He's, you know, using
hyper-realism,
normal grounded details. He's trying to paint a very truthful, realistic picture of his surroundings, and his mental health, but there is so much more care and attention and detail and curiosity for language and place and settings than potentially in, yeah, in that. Yeah.
Than just chucking a sort of zeitgeisty.
Yeah. Frank O'Hara was really good for that stuff as well.
Yeah, I love Frank O'Hara.
He's amazing. Frank O'Hara is this like amazing poet from, he's from New York.
Yeah, he's part of the Beat Poets School of Poetry.
Yeah. And he does a lot of, it's funny because he's writing in what, the 60s?
Yeah.
And it's so contemporary to the 60s. And yet there's still a freshness to it when you read it. And I wonder if like the Charlie Puth thing, like I've not heard that name for like a year. It's like that already feels like an aged reference.
I will argue as well that I think there are artists who are flirting with confessionality in a more interesting way. I would argue that Lorde.
Yeah.
Particularly her last album, Virgin, was a pretty interesting album that reflected a lot of very personal themes. She has that song Clear Blue, which I presume is about her becoming pregnant. And she says, after the ecstasy testing for pregnancy, praying in MP3, your metal detectors hit my precious treasure. I'm nobody's daughter. I'm free. And it's
yeah, that kind of.
Yeah. There's kind of like a poetry to her talking about. And she, you know, it's called Clear Blue, which is the brand of a pregnancy stick.
Yeah.
Which I feel like is a slightly. I don't know, maybe more. I don't want to be prescriptive ever about music. And I use the word elevated lightly because I think that there is a total reason for Taylor Swift existing and why people enjoy it and for the pleasure it brings and also for the domesticity and the kind of, what that provides. And it's very different to what poetry is providing. But yeah, I think that album, for example, from Lorde is a bit more of a nuanced approach to talking about something personal in a musical way.
Yeah. Well, I guess the question is, it always boils down to is like, who's your poet?
Yeah.
For lots of... Hello?
Sorry. That's your poet.
That's my poet calling.
So what about, in contrast, someone who's maybe authenticity, I mean, it's controversial, but doesn't feel forced? Lily Allen? Lily Allen's your album?
Oh, God.
Lily Allen's always laid everything bare.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is why I think it's interesting to me, because bearing in mind her previous albums, like things like Not Fair, where she wrote about how her boyfriend couldn't get it up. Like, she wrote several songs about, I don't know who her boyfriend was, because at the time we weren't taking an interest. Like, at the time we weren't like, whose knob's tiny? Because she was clearly singing about that. Whereas now, obviously, we know. And like, if I were David Harbour... If I were David Harbour and I married Lily Allen, I'd look at her discography. Like, yeah, she's not written music for a little bit, but I'd be thinking, you know, she wrote Fuck You and like sang it at the American president. I'd be thinking, I'm going to tread fucking carefully.
Also, you know it's authentic what she's done, because not only does she clearly fucking hate him from, what's the name of the album?
West End Girl.
West End Girl. It's very clear that she absolutely hates him, but she's also released it during the Stranger Things press tour. So everything about it's calculated on his downfall. That's how you know it's real shit.
And she real sat shit. On it. She sat on it for like a year or something, didn't she?
But it was recorded in like 10 days, I think.
I mean, that's not that long in music terms.
I guess not.
But I think there was a... It was just maybe just under... I think she recorded it in December of 2024 or something. I could be wrong about that. But it came out... It was like a quick birth, as far as I'm aware. Like a 10-day studio hang. And then, went straight into production.
But I think the lyrics in that... And obviously it is... I guess, again, like going back to the Charlie XCX lyric where it's quite literal.
Yeah.
And it's very specific. Like in Pussy Palace, where she's like, there's 100 Trojans and she's talking about butt plugs. And
The Dwayne Reed bag with the handles tied, butt plugs, sex toys, lube inside.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Yeah. It rhymes. But yeah, it's very, literal. And I think, like, I love it. I personally, like, adore that album.
Yeah.
Because I think it really does a good job of capturing what a lot of women, particularly in that stage of life, go through. Like, and that there's lines where, you know, you came up to the bedroom and made it all my fault. And, like, it just, like...
Yeah. Well... Kind of bit of a counterpoint But I'm really interested in your idea of like talking about the truth and stuff like that. I was doing some research before, because obviously this is very much focused on like female musicians and female artists and what does that mean. But we're coming off in 2023 the ruling that rap music can now be used as evidence in court.
Oh.
Yeah, so rap music has almost always been confessional, but not necessarily treated as such, because rappers have always been like, I'm inheriting a bit of a persona, but then at the same time, if they're rapping about things they haven't experienced in their own life, they don't have credibility in the space. Mm-hmm. But there was the Young Thug trial happened. Do you know the US rapper Young Thug?
I have heard of him.
So basically, he went on trial in Atlanta for racketeering, which is like running a criminal street gang called YSL, Young Slime Life, for anyone interested.
It's a good name. Strong.
And basically, this gang have been charged with murder, carjackings, and other alleged crimes. And basically, it got to the point where 28 people were charged, and the prosecutors started using the rap lyrics as proof that they had like disdain for like court proceedings, and that they like, spoke about doing this kind of stuff. And prosecutor Mike Carlson said, the lyrics are being used to prove the nature of YSL as a racketeering enterprise, the expectations of YSL as a criminal street gang. We've got party admissions for even the offence of murder here. This is evidentiary use. So what does that mean?
Well, yeah.
If confession and truth are used as currency by different industries and stuff.
It's like Oscar Wilde, where a picture of Dorian Gray got used against him in court to prove that he was gay.
Yeah.
And I guess that this all comes back to, I guess, like the separation of art from the artist.
Yeah, well, and you know, that's why a lot of people that didn't like the term confessional poetry rejected it, because they didn't like that the I was being read onto the personhood. And I can understand that. And I suppose my take is that I really believe that art should be viewed separately from the artist, but within the context of the artist. And
yeah,
I
think that's fair.
It's a really like complex topical debate, but I don't know if it stands for grounds of proof or evidential fact, because everything that you read has an element of fictionalization or of care and consideration, just as speech does. Like, when do we ever really get to the truth in something? But that debate's really interesting, because it also was really relevant a summer or two ago when we were talking about Drake and Kendrick and their feud and their rap battle, and Kendrick claiming that Drake's a pedophile, Drake claiming that Kendrick beats his wife. They're just like extremely serious sentiments and accusations that were thrown around in a kind of casual setting. And
yeah, what is interesting though is that like rap is often referred to as like an expose or exposing something or shots firing, like you said, rather than confessional.
Yeah.
Whereas like women's music is often.
Exactly. I do think that there is a double standard there, and that we pierce the surface of our female musicians a little bit more. I guess sort of closing statements. Does anyone have anything on their chest that's burning?
I have a burning,
go for it,
sort of sentiment, which is when you were talking about truth, confessional poetry, confessional lyricism, like kind of strives to or may not strive to get to the truth of the matter.
Yeah.
And I think that because, as we've been exploring, as you said earlier, it's, you know, you're looking at like an internal worlds rather than stories that have happened, particularly in the poetry. Mm. Obviously with the Allen album it's different, it's like a story, but like it's still like, you know, internal. And I think the fact that emotions inherently are so fleeting, so something that can be true when you write it and true when you sing it won't be true in 6 months' time.
Mm.
Like, and that's what makes it so difficult to kind of like grasp or pin down whether or not something is.
It was actually, there's the songwriter Maggie Rogers, you know?
Oh, yeah.
She said that, I think Marcus Mumford once told her it never to be bitter in a song, because bitterness is an emotion that doesn't last. Mm. And you don't want to put something out there in the world that you're feeling towards is going to change drastically within a short period of time.
Well, look at Sabrina Carpenter with that. Is it Please, Please, Please? The one that's about Barry.
Don't embarrass me.
Barry Keoghan. And then, you know, they split up and she was still on that tour and she was having to sing that song. You could see it was making her like visibly upset at points. It's like, that sucks. Yeah.
It's a good warning.
Yeah.
Warning to us all.
Do I have any final thoughts? I think we don't have to lay the kind of artistic means as bare as it has been. I think interpretation can make something richer, even if you have to listen to it a few times.
Yeah, it should be like a privilege to be able to access an artist in a life, not an expectation.
Yeah.
I suppose my final take is quite a simple one, is that I love music, but it's not poetry.
Mm. Oh!
That's fair.
And then a final really nice line, which I feel like brings everything together, which is a quote from Adrienne Rich from her poem Planetarium. She says, "I am an instrument in the shape of a woman trying to translate pulsations into images for the relief of the body and the reconstruction of the mind." And I feel like that really nicely encapsulates.
Very nice.
Old fashioned poetry is.
Yeah. Awesome. That's lovely.
Thank you so much
for
that.
Thank you. You're so welcome. And thank you to the Roundhouse for hosting this. And thank you to all of you lovely listeners.
Yes, we're very appreciative. Yeah. So you've awesome. Made it to the end. You're a real one.
Yeah. Thanks, guys.
You're welcome. Cool.